the smallwood rifle.
Many of the people were very primitive indeed and had never seen a white man in their lives. And we began by recruiting Baptist Christians who were Christian and theoretically, but very, very steeped in their ancestral backgrounds. And this is a tribe called the Lahu or Muso, M-U-S-O. The main disadvantage we had in that area was that it was not regarded as a place of recruitment for the Burma army, and the locals were not regarded as really military. The only local I could find was Bina Havildar, who we upgraded to Jemadar, and he was first class. But it's very difficult without any NCOs. We had a few, I'd gone in with a few, but they were fairly low grade people, like the bandsmen of the Burma army and things like that. Not exactly a very warlike lot, but all that there was. Well, we began with that lot, and then from there we went into the Shans. There are several sorts of Shans up there, red Shans and yellow Shans and various ones. And we, after a while, recruited them. And we had absolutely no problem politically, because there were no political parties. None of them had any political leanings. There are some very primitive people up there, some of whom were still cannibals. And so, not generally cannibals, but if you hadn't seen a friend of yours for a couple of years and he came to see you, you'd go and kill your fat young daughter and serve up to him as a treat. There are also some weird people called the Ikors, who are animists, and they didn't believe in washing. They were washed on birth and washed on death. And water was full of evil spirits. It was immensely difficult to get them to cross a river. I only had two or three of them. But wherever we went, we were well received. I mean, everybody ran from a village in the mountains who came on the village. And then they'd send the oldest lady, woman in. And if she wasn't killed, they'd send the oldest man in, and then they'd gradually come back. We treated them extremely well. We paid for everything. The Japanese were raping and paying in paper money. We were paying in gold and silver. And we paid for everything, and we treated the locals very well. All yellow parachutes went to the Ponges, the Buddhist monks, and so on. So we made friends with all those sort of people. And we had an atmosphere which was, I mean, couldn't have been better. An example of the amazing things Japanese do, whilst I was out on patrol, a message came to our headquarters, to Johnny, saying, two Japanese have come to kill you. I said, oh, yes. And he said, where are they? He said, well, they're down in a village, about a day's march from here. Right, he said. He said to us, Ali, he said, it takes six men to go and kill them. He said, not prisoners, no. So he went down there and found them cleaning their teeth, and he killed them. Now, one was a Kempeitai sergeant, you know, secret military police, one sort of secret military police, and one was another man. And he was 10 days' march from any help of any sort kind of description. And the one thing they had which was very good was a radio, and we couldn't use it, this chap, and when he was asked by the village, what have you come for? I've come to kill all the English. And later on, I was talking to, we had a local Japanese captain, wrote him a letter saying, you know, the atomic bomb's been dropped and you should come and surrender. So he said, in excellent English, wrote back and said, I know nothing about atomic bombs. I know nothing about surrender terms. However, if the emperor has said I'm to surrender, I always obey my emperor. He put that in a cleft stick in the middle of a paddy field and put four light machine guns on it, one at each corner. So we knew that was happening. He didn't collect it till he took him away. And I did also the stupidest thing in my life, without any doubt. When we were to re-establish the frontier post at Tarkilek, Siam, there was a big Japanese garrison about 10 miles away. And one in Burma, before they concentrated surrendering, I got on my pony, which we'd captured from the Japanese, a very nice pony, and rode up the road to go and talk to them. When I arrived, I was met by a caricature of Japanese teeth and glasses, and like this, you see. And I said, oh dear me. So I very quietly turned round and walked, rode my pony down 100 yards before the road turned. And it was the longest 100 yards I ever had in my life, because I was sure he was going to shoot me in the back. By which time, my good friend, Jemadar Lee, had stoned out of his mind. And he'd suddenly realized, where was the Tekin, the master? He'd gone, stupid one. So he got 8 men and ran up the road, and just as I got round the corner, he was there. It was a very nice feeling that you were looked after. No, our relationships were wonderful with the locals. Of course, one of the towns, Monping, had a big Italian Catholic mission there. And as they were allies, they were not badly treated by the Japs. And in fact, they said a funeral mass for Ronnie Schoen. We had one done by them.
Which did you prefer, operating in France or in Burma?
Burma. First of all, we had proper air support. I mean, the air support was marvellous. Marvellous. I was given the chance when the monsoon started, that would I like a fortnight's leave in Calcutta? So I said yes. They said, well, just walk up to Chungking, which was 500 miles away. So I decided to stay where I was. And also through all the Japanese lines and everything, you had to sort of, it wasn't all that safe. It was marvellous operating there. I mean, first of all, we could always run away in the jungle. I mean, there's lots of places to go and hide. I mean, the SOE motto should have been, and I always taught people, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. And we were, in my view, too valuable to be slaughtered unnecessarily. And I hope we weren't frightened and did our duty. But the object was to annoy people maximum and stay alive. Because once you were dead, it was very expensive getting you there. And it trained you and bothered you and bothered with you. It was a great mistake to get yourself killed, if you could avoid it. But I think we probably did more, because I never, ever received an order in the field, which was marvellous. We occasionally got a thing, can you do so-and-so? And we said no, that was the end of it. Because they said, we can't judge, the headquarters said, we can't judge what the surgeon, we'd like you to do, can you do it? But I think we did more than we could have been asked to do as a result.
Was the staff work in Southeast Asia any better than it had been in Europe and North Africa?
Well, it's entirely a personal thing, this, again. Throughout the time I was there, Johnny Shaw got all his mail dropped in. And we had these frequent flights, you see. And he always got his mail. My sergeant never got any. And he used to go off into the jungle and cry because it was very bad for his morale. I didn't particularly like it. The only mail I ever got was one letter from the Inland Revenue and one letter from my tailor. All the rest never came at all. I did discover after the war that one lot had gone into another mission. There'd been a Japanese counterattack and they'd captured it and burnt it. Well, that wasn't very efficient. For about 6 weeks, having borne out my jungle boots, I was kept asking for boots and never got them for 6 weeks. I was walking, doing 2 hours a day barefoot, and because I had to try and tough up my feet. I thought, and that was a sign of a fair degree of incompetence. We kept sending signals out saying, you sent us lots of size 8, 6, 7 and 8, but 10. Eventually I got them, but before with my boots. But I mean, that was weeks and weeks before they dealt with it in the mail. And it's very bad morale. In addition, just before you went in, everybody, as far as I know, was promoted. And I became a major. And they never bothered to tell me. Now, it's very good for morale as an idea, but again, bad staff work, having doing it. It was only after the war, I discovered that I had all this pay building up as a major when I thought I was a captain. That, to me, is stupid. You know, lack of good sense, don't you think? I don't know. It seems to me a very, very stupid thing to do. But I think it was a lot better. It was better there than it was in France. Our real sorrow was the war ending. Of course, the saddest thing of all was poor Johnny, when we came out of the field in Rangoon, he went mad and took a pistol and went off to shoot the commanding officer. He went in the bin and they built him up. And everybody said 7 months in the field of a small wood would drive anybody mad.
Is that the reason, do you think?
I hope not. No. We reckon that anybody who did three missions went round the twist. And it's not the time when you're in, it's when you come out, you know, and the pressure's off. You can cope with it whilst it's there all around you, but very difficult once it's, the pressure's off. And he'd been many months in Albania, and then he'd been done another mission. This was his third mission. And the trouble is that they fixed him up, and so he was commanding a company in Korea and was shot off an 8th Hussar tank and was killed.
What was his name? Johnny what?
Johnny Shaw, S-H-A-U-W, Royal Ulster Rifles. One of the finest soldiers I've ever met in my life, and one of the nicest people you could ever wish to meet. He was wonderful. I said to him one time, I was having trouble with my levies, because I specialised in this particular hill tribe, the Muso. And I said, well, what should I do about it? He said, treat them as extremely bad British other ranks, you'd have no problems. Exactly what I did. And they were great.
How did they get you out of Burma in the end?
Well, about 6 weeks after the war ended, they flew a plane in. And this was the time when I had a temptation, when somebody came up to me and said, I've got 3/4 of a ton of raw opium. Will you put it on the plane and give it to so-and-so in Rangoon? And it's worth £250,000 to you. I said, no. Well, I couldn't, could I? But it was quite a temptation at the time. I thought. Any time I've really had a chance of making a lot of money easily. Because there were no controls. You know, I just...
You were telling me earlier off the record that your brother had been in SOA.
Yes.
Can we put something about that on the tape, please?
Right. Well, my brother, Major William Francis Darrell Sinclair Smallwood, was an instructor at Bewley, a specialist in the German army. He was in the intelligence corps. And I know very little about this, really, except that he volunteered to in Force 134, I think it was. 133, I can't remember. Well, it's 133 or 134. Anyhow, for operations in northern Italy. He spoke very good German. And he was in the South Tyrol, the sort of Italian part of the Austrian Empire, where a lot of German speakers, and he was supposed to be making contact with people in Austria. I know extremely little about it. He's never spoken about his torture or anything else. The little I know about it comes from his sergeant, who was one of the very few British other ranks who escaped from prisoner of war camp, and he joined SOE after having come back. And my brother was being carried on a litter in the Dolomites near Madonna di Campiglio when he'd broken his leg climbing, and when he met this Cossack patrol under a German officer, and my brother correctly told the partisan to drop him and go, which they did, perfectly correctly, but his sergeant insisted on staying with him in spite of my brother's orders. And I met him after the war. He's dead now. And what he said to me was, he said, in a way it was fortunate we were tortured together, because he said, if it hadn't been for your brother's splendid example, I would never have been able to resist torture. But he said, I did. And I met people after that. He was in a civil prison for a while after that. The German army treated him well, this German officer, but he was then claimed by the Gestapo. See, that's when it all happened. And he certainly didn't talk. I mean, nothing, he gave nothing away. That's really it's a funny thing that we should both have finished up in SOE in the same way, in different directions.
I think you were saying that he made some comment to you about having volunteered for special forces.
Well, yes, when he heard that I had, he said to me, you do realize what a stupid thing this is, because they will send you on a non-existing escape line to an unsafe, safe house. And he said, they really are both incompetent. Before going in the field, in Ceylon, when we were choosing each other for teams, I met Sergeant Harrison, who'd already been on operations in France, and suggested that he might be prepared to come in the field with Ronnie Sherne and myself. He said he would be pleased and happy, and I said, I must tell you a story first, and that is, in Albania, a certain NCO had been warned by his officers that he was not to go into the village and talk about the messages received from Cairo. It was a liberated part of Albania with several villages. He was to go into the pub and talk. Having warned him twice, the two officers concerned got him to send a signal out asking for a new wireless operator by the next moon, and then sat on a court-martial. This, of course, was illegal. There were only two officers instead of three. However, they tried him, condemned him to death, and shot him. And I said, now, this is a terrible thing, but I must warn you that I know you will behave well in the field, but you must realize I am an officer, you are an NCO. If you were not to behave the way I expected of you, I'd have no hesitation whatever in shooting you. Sergeant Harris said, God, sir, that's a bit rough. And I said, well, that's the way it is. I'm sure it's not necessary. I said, you must realize that it's quite a serious matter. Oh, he said, and he came in all the same. An experience of mine in Burma was the following. One of the locals, after the British had pulled out of Burma, had said to everybody who wished to listen to him, if you ever see the British back in Burma, you can put a ring in my nose and use me to plough the fields like a water buffalo. Well, we were back, not many of us, and not very impressive, but we were there. And he didn't do anything much about it. After a while, however, he started anti-British propaganda and saying that we were awful and this, that and the other. So I asked Johnny Shaw's permission to take six men and go to his village and shoot him, which I was quite prepared to do. I find it shocking now. Fortunately, when I got to the village, he'd run away, so it didn't happen. But I was perfectly prepared to, without a second's hesitation. I was very impressed by an example of army administration. My regiment had been the 24th Lancers. They were written off after about 3 weeks' battle after D-Day. They were a sacrifice division. And as they'd been disbanded, I was no longer a member of a regiment. In the field, I got a message saying, your regiment has been disbanded. You must choose another one. So I said, 9th Lancers, 17th Lancers, the Skins. A week later, you are now a member of the 9th Lancers, which I think was fairly impressive for administration in the field. What it mattered to anybody, I don't know, but they really do follow you up in the British Army.